Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, a mighty fine for skipping stone. To feel fresh as a lemonade setting in the shade. What a fine day to take a stroll and wander by the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, WFVR LP. South Royalton fishing season open up this Saturday, so get those creels and rods and lures and special flies all set. I think you'll recognize this one. Hey, a guy that spent a lot of time in Randolph Center. His family had a place there. Ben Winship here, joined by David Thompson. I'm not sure who the vocalist is, but you probably recognize the Andy Griffith theme. Green Zine is brought to you today by Soliflect, Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, and White River Land Collaborative. Hey, by the way, they have rescheduled their vernal pool walk. We'll tell you about that.
When we get to the fishing hole, there'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to do a little time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to char and maybe set in jar. Take down your fishing pole, meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
Send that opening piece out to some fishing buddies here who are part of our staff at Free Vermont Radio, and they would include a guy that knows all about it. In fact, he is a guide down there at the Woodstock Inn, Shea Berry. Also our good friend Two Scoops Duffy and the Murphy Brothers. Yeah, those guys are probably all set for fishing season to start. And yeah, we'll try to get that information about the White River Land Collaborative. I just went to their website. And I didn't see the vernal pool reschedule, but I think it's this Sunday. I think it's this Sunday. Someone out there is listening who has a exact date could probably email me, and I think they know my email address, and I'll be able to give that before the show ends. Hey, Henry Swayze. Oh, is that you coughing out there, Henry?
I'm afraid it was. I didn't have my my cough button on.
Well, I just slid you up. I hope you're okay. You're healthy, aren't you?
I am good. I just had a swallow of something that a drop of it went down my windpipe.
Okay, gotcha.
I just want to comment on the tail end of Green Zine. Excuse me, of
Radio Eco Shop.
Radio Eco Shop.
Sure.
They were talking artificial intelligence.
They were.
And its pros and cons. And we attempted to get the state chief guru on artificial intelligence to be on today. And he says, tried to make it happen today, but 2 weeks from now, You got me. So we will have a discussion. We actually have an official position with someone who has to figure out about artificial intelligence for the state of Vermont.
Yeah, I hope he's very. I hope he's nonpartisan. This is not a political position. I hope he's very nonpartisan and just goes through it.
Whatever he is, I bet that he is looking at it from the grand overview.
Yeah,
and not on anybody's.
I'd like to point out a magazine that we don't normally refer to here on Green Zine. They do occasionally actually have pieces from Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, not related to the funny guy on TV. But The New Yorker, about a month ago, carried the longest piece of that issue, was all about artificial intelligence and a lot of young people that are gathering, both those who think it's going too fast and those who think it's going to be a great boon to humanity. So if you did a little bit of research online and looked for that article, I'm not sure we're allowed to post it here, but very thorough. I learned a whole lot. Some of it was scary, some of it so not. But great, so a couple weeks away from this official joining us here on Green Zone.
Yes.
Yep,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't without reward for having persisted and sent him multiple messages.
Yeah, you are very persistent. Good job, Henry.
So, so today we have lots of stuff in the program.
And very diverse, too. Very diverse
and
content.
Quite diverse. So we're going to, there is a landmark decision that was made 3 days ago by the European Court of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a group of Swiss women, elderly people,
yep,
who have been complaining at the Swiss government that they aren't doing enough about climate change. And they have taken them to court multiple times trying to get them to do more. And one of their factors is that that women actually, especially elderly women, experience climate change differently, heat in particular, differently than men do.
Mm.
And so they were standing up for their rights as women who have a lower threshold for when their system goes bottom side up because of heat. And they won in the Court of Human Rights, and we will be hearing about that. And then some comments on that from a Vermont Law School professor who's in Europe and would be on the program to talk about it. But we have some comments from her, and because she is teaching at the time that we're doing this program.
Yeah, interesting. I think she's teaching a class that actually is being shared between the campus here, some students here on the campus in South Royalton, and the professor over in Europe.
I know that she's teaching people on both sides of the ocean, whether they're doing...
Yeah, wherever they are.
The same class or not, I don't know.
It's time to zoom in, yeah.
Yeah. And then for a major piece of that we're going to pay attention to is on how much urban land policy can do for climate.
Mm.
So there's been a lot of talk, and the legislature has paid attention to this, of how do you make neighborhoods walkable? How do you make it so that we drive less and live better in the process? And this brings some real numbers to it, just how good it is for the environment. So that will be something that we'll get into in some detail.
Okay. Well, right now, I think we're going to check in with our friends, the birds, as we go to our weekly segment of Bird Note, just to remind people that you are listening to Green Zine. We've been doing the show for just a little bit over 11 years. Your hosts are Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson. Indeed, spring is bursting forth out there.
This is Bird Note. We often hear it said that spring bursts forth as if winter's leafless trees suddenly shimmer with green. Flowers pop. Birds start singing with all their hearts. But this seasonal change isn't instantaneous. It's a series of waves, slowly breaking waves that sweep up from the south to the north, right over the continent. Early spring migrants, like robins and bluebirds, return north in March, some even in February. Across the whole of April, week after week, new songbird migrants work north from the tropics, adding bit by bit to spring's ever-growing soundtrack. By May, birds continue flooding into northerly states in Canada. And even as late as June, birds like willow flycatchers and mourning warblers are just completing the trek to northern breeding sites from South America. By this time, those early robins may already be hard at work feeding their second brood. For them, spring has been bursting for over 3 months. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Oh, I loved all those bird calls on that bird note, Henry.
Yeah. So the first bird to sing in the morning is a robin. I've mentioned that before, and we're I'm in Burlington again this Green Zine time. And we slept with the windows pretty much wide open because it was fairly warm here. It was maybe upper 40s, lower 50s last night. And at 4:25 this morning, robins were going at it. And I looked out the window and I said, well, there isn't even a glimmer of daylight coming, and the robins are out there singing.
Mm.
And so I kind of turned over and went back to sleep. And the next thing I heard was more calls, but it was cardinals.
Yep.
And they were the ones that were peeping up after dawn just got going. And the robins were nowhere to be heard. So early bird gets the worm, and I guess the robin is the worm finder.
Indeed. Hey, I've got some bird behavior that was interesting that occurred to me yesterday when I went to get the chickens going in the morning. We just have three chickens, and they get fed a little hot mash. And so we have lots of chickadees. I think people in this area, and that's probably the most prevalent bird here. Over winters, the birds are around all the time. And they were really flitting about, quite a few of them, and they were literally kind of bumping into each other. I thought maybe they were mating, but they seemed to be, not quite fighting. And they were buzzing very close to me, just kind of zipping around. Normally, they kind of keep their distance. And there were groups of them that were having this sort of bumping. Have you ever seen that kind of behavior from chickadees?
I've had them get very close to me, and they seem to be fearless, and they get very used to who you are. And I haven't seen them in a frenzy zone like that.
Yeah, that's what my impression was, almost like a frenzy zone.
We have a bird feeder right outside of our kitchen window here in Burlington. And there were some really beautifully plumed, very subtle, but beautifully plumed wrens on the bird feeder. And I had recently had a birthday and got a fixed focused telephoto lens for my camera.
Nice.
And so fixed focus lenses are always sharper than zoom lenses. And I've been looking for things to do with that. And I thought, well, I'll get a picture of this this bird on the bird feeder. And I focused it, and I was getting reflections off the glass, and the bird wasn't paying any attention to me, and they flew off. And so I opened the window so that I could take a picture without the glass in the way. I thought, well, this will be easy as pie. And the first bird that flew in did a U-turn, never landed on the bird feeder, and flew away.
Mm-hmm.
And the second bird that flew in did the same thing. And I waited there for 5 minutes. I figured if I just held still, they'd come to the bird feeder.
Nothing
came back to the bird feeder.
Nope.
Closed the window, they got birds back at the bird feeder. So they somehow figured out that it was different, and that maybe they weren't seeing the reflection of the wood pile or whatever they usually see
right.
on the glass.
Yeah.
But they saw me as threatening.
Yeah. Well, their orientation was changed. Well, you'll get the shot the next time around, Henry.
Yeah, but I just thought it was interesting that they picked up on that. I was quite amazed. The first bird, I thought, well, you know, that was just an anomaly. But then when no one showed up after the second bird did the U-turn, I said, well, they've talked to each other and my jig's up. I can't do this.
No way. Hey, so we're rolling right through the show. We're about 16 minutes past the hour. I do have that segment about that landmark climate change case from Switzerland. Shall we go with that first portion of that,
yeah,
Henry?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, here it goes. You're tuned to Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio.
Europe's top human rights court has ruled in favor of a group of elderly Swiss women who said their government violated their human rights by not doing enough to combat climate change. Dozens of supporters of the Swiss women were in court to hear the outcome, including the environmental campaigner Greta Thunberg.
People have been living on the front lines of the climate emergency and have been witnessing and bearing the brunt of its consequences for a very long time.
This is not a future threat we're talking about here. It's a current planetary emergency where hundreds of thousands of people are being affected, are losing their homes, are becoming climate refugees, are losing their lives, suffering severe health catastrophes.
The Swiss president, Viola Emhert, said the ruling did nothing to change her government's commitment to sustainability, biodiversity and net zero. I asked our correspondent, Imogen Folkes, exactly what today's ruling says.
The fundamental part of this judgment, which is what, in fact, the Swiss women who brought their particular case were looking for, was that the court make a link between climate change, or more specifically, failure to do enough to tackle it, and human rights. And the court has done precisely that. What it said is that the Swiss government's lack of action on tackling greenhouse gas emissions has violated people's rights to what it's quite specific, it's about private and family life. But what it refers to is the records these Swiss women brought to the court, which showed that they were having to stay indoors alone for days and weeks on end, not seeing their families or grandchildren during these extreme heat waves, which Switzerland is seeing more and more of. The fundamental thing, you're not doing enough, and climate change is linked to human rights. I think that will have repercussions right across Europe.
So does this put some kind of legal obligation on the Swiss government, and by implication other governments, to combat climate change, to reduce global temperatures?
Switzerland cannot appeal this ruling, and it has been told that its current strategy is inadequate, that it has not properly shown its workings about what it's actually doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that it has not met its targets. So Switzerland is now obliged to do something about that. And for other countries in Europe, it sets a precedent, because it is the very first time that the European Court of Human Rights has ruled on a climate change case like this. We know that in other courts there are similar cases coming down the line, but the fact that the court has told today a member state, one which many people think has a stellar record in environmental matters, that it's not doing enough and that is therefore violating the rights of its own citizens, is really quite historic.
We were talking earlier about some other cases being heard by the same court. They were ruled inadmissible.
That's right. There was one from Portuguese young people. But what the European court said is, look, what you needed to do, these young people, is go through your own domestic courts in Portugal first. The Swiss women went right through the Swiss legal system before they ended up in Strasbourg. The other case from France was an individual concerned who no longer lives where he made the complaint related to climate change and flooding. So that was ruled inadmissible as well.
Our correspondent, Imogen Folk.
Well, Henry, very interesting. That last person didn't have standing once they moved away. They weren't within the jurisdiction of the Swiss court. Yeah, really interesting story. Let's follow up on it before we go back to it.
Yeah, and so the Vermont Law School, Ashley Stetzer, commented, because I asked her to cover this subject, and she commented that it wasn't available, but she said this is a watershed moment. It could be have a big effect. And then she went on to say that just to note some frustration with the holdings, that's a court ruling, like these, is lacking of formal enhancement enforcement mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says something we hear time and time again in international law. States opt in to being held to account, thereby giving up their sovereign right, which states are rarely incentivized to do unless there's something in it for them. And in the U.S. Is rarely not one of these states. Given the party that's currently in rule in Switzerland, they're thinking about throwing a tantrum and calling to leave the Council of Europe and Europe based on the very decision that was made.
Yes.
So it's a wait and see game, she says, and also that this is a European court, and it's a note that the Swiss are not members of the European Union, which I didn't know that.
They've been pretty independent. Yep.
Yeah. Huh. So anyway, the devil's in the detail with everything, but I really feel there's some power in the law telling truth to climate and starting to hold governments and corporations responsible.
Yeah, you know what?
Vermont.
I also found it interesting that the older Swiss women that were bringing this case, at least successfully in front of the International Court of Justice or the European Court of Justice, was that, yeah, they were changing their lifestyle to protect their physical health because of extreme heat, but it was having an effect on their. It didn't mention emotional distress, but I thought about that literally if they can't visit their family, they can't carry their lives on and normal, they're being denied sort of the simple human right of being able to, enjoy family life, to get out and about, not to be restricted to their home because there's 30 days of potential fatal heat happening. So we'll have to track that case and maybe in the future compare it to some of the cases like the Giuliana case here that Gus Speth has spoken about before. Maybe make that link.
Yeah.
Shall we return to the piece, Henry?
Just one more comment.
Okay.
And that is that I listened to another piece of coverage for this, which I didn't record. And one of the women said that she had been out in 95 degree temperature, and I took it that she was maybe late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she wasn't feeling very good in the heat, but she decided to kind of bull her way through and not be sent off into the, you know, into the indoor air-conditioned life, and that she landed up basically in a sick bed because of it. And so 95 degrees is not all that hot. I thought that was interesting, and that women actually have, especially elder women who don't sweat as much, or have less tolerance.
And also, yeah, when you think about geography and Switzerland, you know, as far as, I don't know how it compares to Vermont, but I don't think, and I can't do the math or whatever to get to centigrade, 95 degrees in Switzerland is way, way, way above a normal high in that country. And people's bodies just can't really acculturate to that. Or acclimate to that.
That's 95 Fahrenheit. That's the conversion.
Yeah.
It was
95 Fahrenheit. Yeah. I bet you a normal high temperature in Switzerland when a heat wave is coming through 20 years ago is probably more like 80 or 85, something like that.
Yeah.
It is a mountainous country. So shall we go back for another 3 minutes to this segment?
Yes. So this is some more on just how fast climate change is coming at us.
Okay, here we go. You're listening to Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio.
The ruling came as new figures show the world has experienced record-breaking heat for 10 months in a row. The EU's Climate Change Service said March was the warmest ever recorded, with temperatures now at 1.68 degrees higher than before industrial times, and the rise in the temperature of the sea surface even more dramatic. Samantha Burgess says it's a worrying trend.
These records are telling us that our climate is warming, it's warming rapidly, and climate change isn't a future problem, it's a present problem impacting everyone around the world.
So what's driving this record-breaking heat? Matt McGrath is our environment correspondent.
It's the long-term use of fossil fuels, deforestation, human activities, if you like, driving up levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that is warming our planet. That is the underlying and overlying cause as well. But this has also been aided and abetted by an El Nino weather phenomenon. It's a naturally occurring event in the Pacific which sees large amounts of heat come from the seas to the skies. That's been running now for about a year. It's peaked in December, and it has added a fraction to the top of that, which is why we're seeing this long-term run of record months dating back to last June.
Give me a sense of the impact that these rising temperatures are already having in different parts of the world, let alone our fears of what might follow.
One of the biggest impacts that people are seeing around the world is how warm the seas are, and that is leading on to many other problems. But the seas are so warm at this particular time that they are really breaking records in an unprecedented way. The seas at the moment in March were the warmest they've ever been, and that can lead to greater storms. People are worried about the potential for hurricanes and tropical storms during the later part of the summer and into the autumn because the seas contain such heat. But we're also seeing a lot of rainfall in various places, and this is another impact of climate change, because the greater the warming, the more moisture can be held in the skies, if you like, and that then falls as very heavy rainfall. In fact, 67% of the world had greater than average moisture throughout March as well. So we're seeing greater heat, we're seeing greater moisture, and there's concerns about storms into the future.
We're pretty used to hearing these climate warnings now. Scientists are saying, hang on a minute, we're now in uncharted territory. What do they mean? What are they concerned about now?
The big worry here from scientists that we've spoken to is that while we're in an El Nino at the moment, it's expected to fade over the next 4 or 5 months and be replaced by a La Nina, which sees colder water come to the surface and cool temperatures. They're worried that if the drop in temperatures that we experience later this year isn't sufficient, then something fundamentally different may be happening in the climate, and we may be in a period of far faster and more dangerous warming. But that is all to play for. They will be watching the temperatures very closely from June, July, August onwards. If there's a significant dip, they'll say it's climate change as we know it. If there's not a significant dip, they say we may be in a different place.
I don't think I want to go to that place, Henry.
Well, I think we're headed there. I'm afraid I'm a pessimist. So the Citizens Climate League is celebrating this entire month and trying to have people stir up conversations with their friends, neighbors, family, people they met on the street about climate, because they're saying no one is really adequately thinking about this. We're just all pushing it to the back of the closet and not doing our housekeeping and and facing up to the fact that we really need to take action.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways we can take action is this next piece is a very simple approach, is to welcome additional housing in our most dense areas that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
And it really attaches some figures to just how much carbon reduction happens when you address these policies.
Yeah, so I think we're about to go to the Volts piece, how much can urban land use policy do for the climate? Henry, and now we're at about 29 minutes to go. Can we do the shorter version? I think you had two versions of this.
Sure, let's do the shorter version.
Yeah, we'll do the shorter version because we do have some local things we want to tell some folks about. And here we go with a different David Roberts than the one that represents the Vermont EV, but how much from Volts. Here we go.
All right, everyone, welcome to Volts for April 10th, 2024. How much can urban land use policy do for the climate? I'm your host, David Roberts. It has become common among urbanists and YIMBYs, groups of which I definitely count myself a member, to say that the climate movement should embrace urban land use policy as a major area of focus. After all, it is well established that communities in which people drive less and live closer together emit less carbon dioxide. Solve the housing shortage and the climate crisis at once. Sounds great. I have always felt slightly ambivalent about this argument, though. Don't get me wrong, I think denser, more walkable communities are desirable for a whole panoply of reasons. They are, relative to car-focused sprawl, more economically vibrant, and more conducive to physical, psychological, social, and even political health. But are they, relative to other items on the climate policy menu, the fastest, most economically efficient, or most efficacious way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions specifically? Can they match the speed and scale of, say, electrifying the light vehicle fleet? What is the scale we're really talking about here? Last month, the think tank RMI released an analysis concluding that, quote, addressing America's chronic housing shortage intelligently by building more housing where most people need it can deliver similar climate impact as the country's most aspirational transportation decarbonization policy. That caused me to sit up. So this week, I am talking with two of the authors of that analysis, Heather House, a manager in RMI's carbon-free transportation program, and Rashad Nanavati, the head of Third Derivative, an early-stage climate tech accelerator co-founded by RMI, to better understand the role of urban land use in the overall climate picture. All right then, with no further ado, Heather House, Rashad Nanavati, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us, David. We're really excited to be here.
This is a subject in which I'm obsessed, and I've been meaning to do a pod on this forever. I think there's a bunch of different ways into this subject, and there'll probably be a bunch of different pods I'll do on it. But I want to focus kind of on the big climate picture. So as I said in the intro, I love good urbanism for a million reasons. Everybody should. I've completely land use pilled, as they say. I did the cliched thing. I went to Barcelona for a few weeks and it ruined me. It utterly ruined me for...
It gets even better than Barcelona, though.
I can't take it, though. I can't take better than that. I came back from Barcelona. I just walk around Seattle now looking around being like, you could fit a whole apartment there. You could fit a whole apartment there. So I love this stuff. But my question, and I have sort of two questions, one of which we'll spend most of our time on. One is it really the best climate policy, if you're just focusing on greenhouse gas emissions, is this the fastest or best way to do things? And then two, which maybe we can get to a little bit at the end, political implications of attaching this to climate, of making this a climate thing. And we can talk about that later. So just to start, the big picture of urban sprawl and its contribution to greenhouse gases globally. Maybe, Heather, you can start there.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. When we look at the global picture, urban sprawl is directly or indirectly responsible for a third of all greenhouse gas emissions.
A third of global greenhouse gas emissions.
That's a lot. But it's still generally overlooked as a major contributor to the climate crisis. Both our analysis within RMI is showing that if we are going to have any pathway to staying on a climate alignment, we're going to have to reduce VMT in the United States by 20%, along with getting 70 million EVs on the road. So those two strategies are going to have to be complementary.
A note for listeners who may not know, VMT refers to vehicle miles traveled.
Yeah.
So you just have to reduce the amount people are traveling in cars.
Yeah.
We're also seeing similar analysis globally as well. I'm not sure if you caught the analysis that ICCT put out last year, but they put out analysis showing that if we're going to do an all-out scenario to even stay aligned with a 1.7 degree C scenario, we're going to have to both electrify everything, but also reduce the amount that we're driving and shift to more efficient modes of transportation. So land use reform is going to be absolutely critical if we want to have any chance at staying aligned with 1.5 or 1.5 degree C scenario.
Why is that? What is that when we say urban sprawl contributes emissions, what do we mean by that exactly? In what way? Through what means?
My addition to what Heather said would be, one, there's a really, really strong relationship between urban form and per capita emissions. And it's a near universal relationship. So you see it everywhere in the world, and you see it regardless of differences in climate, wealth, culture, demographics, whatever.
Yeah, and I should just point out, because this always blows my mind, if people want to Google these maps, it not only holds like between cities, it holds within cities.
Oh, absolutely.
It holds within neighborhoods. Like, it's wild.
Yeah.
How consistent it is. Density means less emissions on almost every level of analysis.
Yeah. So to throw out one data point as an example, right? When you compare Stockholm's per capita emissions, and I'm you know, cherry picking data here, okay? But the point holds. When you compare Stockholm's per capita emissions against those of the US average, you're talking about emissions in the US on a per capita basis that are 600% higher. You can't explain that away with the grid mix. You can't explain it away with culture or consumption patterns. The thing that explains it is urban form. And, you know, in some ways, it's obviously intuitive, right? Sprawl means more roads, more cars, bigger houses, more land. But despite that, it's massively neglected as a climate action lever. And, you know, I have one sort of relatively simplistic way of looking at it, right? When you think about the energy transition, there's the supply side, where essentially everything hinges on carbon-free electricity. That's the master key.
Yes.
On the demand side, urban form is the closest thing we have to a master key. It's critical to unlocking emissions across sectors. You referenced transportation, and that's the most obvious one. You reduce travel distances, you reduce car dependencies.
Right.
But the impacts that are, you know, relatively unappreciated or at least underappreciated are the embodied carbon in the built environment, both buildings and infrastructure. There's 40% less embodied carbon on average in the average multifamily housing unit than there is in a single family one. Reducing energy consumption in buildings. So detached single family homes consume way, way more energy. And by the way more energy is required to actually transmit and distribute that electricity and water to them in the first place. And then you actually reduce emissions associated with land systems change. And in particular, displacement of very rich, productive agricultural land on the urban periphery to places where productivity is much lower. And so when you add up all of those impacts, then the point Heather made to start with, you know, suggesting that urban sprawl is directly or indirectly, and indirectly is a key word here, responsible for one third of all greenhouse gas emissions, it starts to make sense. You know, the caveat on that is it's a good paper, but it's a you know, it's a thesis dissertation by a very smart individual, but hasn't exactly been through the rigorous review process.
The one that came up with sprawl being a third of global emissions?
Yes.
That's, I think we can just say that's directionally, you know, helpful.
Exactly.
I don't think
it's defensible.
It's not precise. It's not precise.
Yeah.
The people who are skeptical toward this as a climate solution, I think one of the questions they would have, I'm going to do a little devil's advocating here.
Love it.
Is you take the emissions out of the cars by electrifying them, take the emissions out of the buildings by electrifying them and attaching them to clean energy. In other words, if you attach both cars and buildings to clean electricity, what's the remainder? What, in other words, what land use itself, you know, what's the remainder there?
I think one thing that's worth pointing out is the life cycle emissions. Even if we electrify vehicles, there's going to be emissions from upstream and from recycling as well. So,
oh, you mean making the cars?
Exactly. So if we can reduce the amount that people need to drive overall, we're going to be reducing emissions upstream for the entirety of the life cycle of a vehicle.
Hmm.
There's two additional points, right? One is the stock versus flow point, right? Like people own their cars on average for 10 or 12 years, and that's increasing, by the way.
Is it?
So even if we flip some magical switch today and got to 100% EV sales tomorrow, we'd still have nearly 100 million internal combustion engine vehicles on the road in the US today. And just to put the numbers in context, 2022 EV sales were less than 14 million. We have 112 million registered light-duty vehicles. In
yes.
Right? So there's this stock versus flow problem.
The problem is growing.
Exactly. And we did this analysis, right? What would it look like to do an all-of-the-above strategy with respect to transportation emissions reductions? And the thing that you see is that material emissions reductions associated with demand reduction, with that whole system strategy, with reducing VMT, they start now, material emissions. Because as soon as you take a vehicle off the road, you have reduced emissions, regardless of the powertrain of that vehicle. Whereas electrification only starts to deliver big material impact in emissions terms once you've achieved a reasonably high penetration in terms of on-road vehicles, right? So there's this stock versus flow issue. The general perception is it's faster to electrify, but the fact is the faster way to reduce emissions, and this is regardless of context, whether you're talking about transportation or any other sector, is actually reduce demand. The second point I'll make is that these strategies are entirely complementary, and by reducing demand, you're actually accelerating the process of electrification. You're making it easier and faster and cheaper to get to 100% penetration of EVs or clean energy or whatever else it is.
Yeah, reducing the distance to target.
Yeah. And so, you know, VMT reduction can happen while this long, but accelerating progress or process of full electrification is playing out.
Right. So let's then look at this recent analysis. It's basically trying to look at, in the U.S., what is the scale of emission reductions available through good land use policy. So maybe, Heather, you could just tell us a little bit about that analysis and how it worked.
So we wanted to better understand how compact development can impact greenhouse gas emissions related to transportation, the built environment, and land systems change. So we estimated the impact of climate-friendly land use policies for all of the states, except for Alaska. Unfortunately, we didn't have the data for that. And what it was showing us was that state-level land use reform, encouraging compact development, can avoid an annual U.S. pollution of 70 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2033, which is not insignificant. This is actually equivalent to half the country adopting California's ambitious commitment to 100% zero emission passenger vehicle sales by 2035. You mentioned that in your introduction, and I think this is something that we really need to look at. A local equivalency is, if we look at Colorado, our analysis found that the greenhouse gas emissions reduction would amount up to 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide in 2033, which is equivalent to 500,000 gas-powered vehicles being driven for a year.
Hmm. How to think about that number is something I want to come back to, but let's talk about the analysis anymore. So a couple of things. One is, when you say you modeled good land use policy, my understanding is that what you modeled is, you know, we have X population growth projected for this state. Let's model that population growth going into those areas of the state where they already have lower VMT, basically. Like, let's channel new population growth to the places where there's already less driving. Is that roughly what you mean when you say you modeled good land use policy? Like, that's what you modeled, yes?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. We looked at emissions associated with new housing a decade from now, using two things. One, the population growth forecasts and housing under production data to project new housing construction. And then we also looked at census block level data sets, estimating residential vehicle miles traveled, the amount that we're driving, to determine transportation emissions in each state under different housing development scenarios.
Right. So just to be clear, like, this is not modeling the full suite of what you could imagine doing in urban reform. It's not even really about making places that now suck better. It's just channeling population growth to the places that are already doing well, basically. Yeah. Like this.
Yeah. And I'd say, David, channeling might even be too strong a word. What you're doing is simply allowing it to happen, because right now it's not allowed to happen.
Right. I guess one way to look at this is a kind of a low-end estimate, because you could do a lot more than that, right? Like, you could, for instance, you could create new good places. Like,
absolutely.
You could reduce VMT in places where they are high rather than just, you know, piling population into where it's already good. So,
yeah,
I just wanted to kind of clarify that. This is not exhaustive urban land use policy.
It's not the upper end. And to give you a sense of, this isn't an upper bound either, but gives you a sense of what might be achieved. So a lot of this analysis was driven by Zach Zubin, who's now at the Turner Center, which focuses on housing policy. And analysis he did, this was a while ago, showed that if you essentially employed the same strategy and encouraged growth in, addressed the housing shortage essentially entirely in the lowest VMT locations, you'd see something like a 200 million ton decrease relative to business as usual. And to maybe sort of bring this down to the household level, a household with $80,000 in annual surplus income in the U.S. can account for anywhere typically between 20 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent a year or 80, depending purely on where they live. This is sort of based on analysis by UC Berkeley's Cool Climate Center. And again, this is a point that you made earlier in the conversation. They found that relationship applying consistently across jurisdictions and found that urban infill was almost invariably one of the top three climate action levers within local government control across the state of California. So that 70 million ton figure, yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's conservative, or at least it's by no means an upper bound.
Well, I was going to get to this later, but let's wrestle with it now, because I'm wrestling with how to think of that figure. On the one hand, it's a lower bound in that this is a pretty modest reform, right? You're just channeling.
All right, we're going to bring that down in the mix. That is the shorter version of this urban land use policy discussion. Pretty interesting, Henry.
Yeah, and so that's an hour-long podcast, as his podcasts normally are.
Uh-huh.
And we'll put a link to that up in the GreenZine notes that are on the website in the far lower right-hand corner. I don't know how many of you people visit those links, but
it's building, Henry. It's building. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hey, is there, you know, speaking of feedback, so when they go to those links, are you okay with, or maybe you already have your email address there? So if they were to see a link and they enjoyed it or had a question, they'd be able to contact you directly. Is that something you've set up?
No, that's not in there, and I will do that. Okay. I will put that in, because I would be pleased to have some feedback about whatever we're doing, right and wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
And so just, I want to review some of the things that they said, just to kind of, because I've now listened to this podcast three or four times.
Wow.
So
you don't sleep, Henry. No wonder those robins were awake.
I'm trying to figure out what what's interesting, what isn't, what and where. I always look for the levers of change.
Okay.
And so what they're saying is you need, if we can make things more dense, that we get as much as a 600% or six times reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So the difference between living in suburban sprawl versus living in a an urban environment where there is, I grew up in Manhattan, and so there was no place for a car in New York, and it was all buses and subways and things like that. And that, together with the housing, when you heat your apartment in New York, you're heating the apartment next door as well. and so that there's an efficiency in that. And I'm not saying that Vermont can be New York City, but certainly right now we have a lot of rules that make it so we can't increase density. And there are bills in the legislature to rework Act 250 to try and make more density be able to happen, and in particular in places where there is already a city center with public sewage, and that kind of indicates that there's a reasonable amount of density there. One of the things they go on that podcast to say is that in some locations there are rules that say that if you have a plot of land that is allowed to have a dwelling on it, that it's not limited to one dwelling. It can be set up for as many as four people living in that location, or four different tenants, or whatever you want to call it. And we're certainly doing that with putting an extra apartment over the garage and things like that, mostly for granny and grandpa, but that turns into a rental apartment in the future, maybe when grandma and grandpa aren't there anymore. And so that's an increase in density we're getting now. Anyway, those were just kind of wanted to put it in trying to put it in perspective. And if you have an opportunity to pay attention, to follow the bills in the legislature, this kind of reform really makes a difference in greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, and not that Vermont really has very many urban areas, but we do have villages, some of them more compact than others. So something you can kind of do for your own sort of hometown homework is look around the buildings that are sort of in your village centers and imagine if and when they change, either residency or maybe there's a rather large home that a single older person is living in that could probably be converted into several apartments or maybe senior citizen housing where folks can walk easily to the post office and to the general store, etc., and start to look around and then participate in meetings of planning commission and at the select board and sort of kind of lay the groundwork for this not overly, dense thing like in a really, downtown Manhattan or downtown Boston, etc. And, kind of have some citizen activism around this, particularly with this progress that's happening here in the state of Vermont.
Yeah. And that goes back to generating clean energy, too. What the towns decide they want to do makes a difference. The House Energy Committee had a hearing this week where they were talking about ground source heat pumps. So, for instance, in South Royalton, you have a sewer system. That sewer system has water that's come out of houses and been used for bathing and washing dishes and so forth that has heat in it. And you can scoop some of that heat
back out of that water before it gets discharged through a ground source heat pump and distribute it among a collection of buildings. And that's currently allowed for an individual, like an apartment building can do that, but it's not allowed across multiple right now. So that's in process, sounding like that will happen. So it's, there's benefit in paying attention to what can happen in the more compact areas.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Hey, Henry, I'm going to forward you this email that I'm looking at. I get a lot of notices of programs that are on Public Radio Exchange and on the Pacifica Radio Network that we have access to. This one is Extinction Rebellion Radio, XR Radio. Looks like they produce a 28-minute show each week. And this week, they're featuring a book. So when I send you to this, Henry, you might want to post this because folks might be interested in this new book. It's called The Wretched of Mother Earth. And one of the co-hosts of XR Radio has written it, Alcee Lane. And it is a book that weaves real data about the climate with a fictional story about the future. And actually, if I send you this whole email, they'll be able to link and listen to it. But also they might be interested in the book itself. Also, Henry, while I have the microphone, I want to remind people that the Owl Festival, let's see if I can bring it up here. Is this it? No, that's Gardening for Wildlife. Anyway, I know that VINS is hosting their annual Owl Festival this Saturday with events all day. If you just go to vins.org, you can get more information on that. And I'm going to go back to you in just a second, Henry, but I will take a moment. The time for comments on the Telephone Gap Project closed the other day, on Monday to be precise. But an interesting letter from Alan Coulter of Weybridge here, who is arguing for this. At this point in time, we need old forests to sequester and store carbon to slow climate change. Early successional forests created by cutting releases carbon dioxide, not only in the road building, improving, cutting, transporting, and manufacturing or burning of the wood, but also after the cut, in the rotting of roots and soil organisms. We need maximum sequestration and storage of carbon now, not in 20 plus years after cut stands regrow. Let the old mature. That sounds like forests and people together. Late successional stands keep growing into old growth on public land rather than tax-subsidized logging. The no-action alternative plan would do this best and be of the most public good. Log on private lands where 90% of the logging is done in Vermont and on the thousands of acres of already approved logging in GMNF. If you're concerned, make people aware of this. All right, Henry, back to you.
Yeah, so VCAN, the Vermont Energy and Climate Action Network has a whole series of potential things you can do. And if you go to VCAN and their newsletter, you can find those. So there's a webinar that is what's afoot in the legislative session that is, I don't know whether it happened tomorrow, or I think it's happening tomorrow. There is a spring summit coming up.
Yes.
And so this is a chance to get together. It's at the law school. I think we've mentioned this before, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And that is on June 1st.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
That will fill up. They will probably run out of space in that. So So you want to register to attend. I have done that.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of these nonprofits that are scheduling conferences. REV has got their fall conference. I noticed that the Energy Action Network is going to have a conference at Bolton Valley. GreenZine is your place to be for getting information on that. And as we learn it, we will post it at our links. I do want to thank the folks that keep GreenZine on the air as we head towards Democracy Now! On this Thursday. They include Solaflect and Bail. Find out more about Bail at bailvt.org. Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee, Solar Fest, and White River Land Collaborative. We're listening to a little bit music of Sun Squabby. We need the sun to come back, Henry, before next week.
It's going to be there a little bit on the weekend.
Okay, we'll look forward. Thanks for joining us. Next time on the radio.
Yeah, bye-bye.